this passage is not at all about reincarnation. First of all, the idea of reincarnation in Hinduism is far from understood today correctly in accordance with the ancient understanding of reincarnation, which is much closer to what we would call transmigration. And the idea of coming back into this world as a plant or a mineral or whatever is not what the original Hindu cosmology was about. It's far more complex than that. And for the Muslims, the only reincarnation that really mattered is the literal adoption of a new body, the bringing about of a new creation, a khalq jadid, on the Day of Judgment. But then that was so important that all the rest is insignificant. What happened between now and the Yom Alast, the day on which, as seeds of consciousness, we accepted the lordship of God? The Quran is silent about that whole intervening cosmic period in which the samsara of Hinduism could easily find a place. It's not as if it contradicts it. But when the Hindus and Buddhists talk about samsara, they're talking about what today physicists are referring to as, in string theory, of billions of universes invisible to us, but existing out there somewhere. That's really what they mean. Reincarnation is transmigration through all those worlds. The Quran wants our focus to be totally on where we are now and where we're going in the future. So this sort of speculation about what we have been in previous possible incarnations is irrelevant to the spiritually galvanizing message of the Quran: prepare for the hereafter. That's the only reincarnation you need to worry about. You will be re-embodied, but in a form appropriate to the spiritual hereafter, so prepare for that. Now, what Rumi is really getting at here is that, is the, if you like, the very opposite of reincarnation, the insan al-kamil, the total, perfect, complete human being. Each one of us is made in the image of God, and in the image of all of God's names and attributes. All of those names and attributes have certain outward manifestations, effects, properties in the universe. And it's only the human being that is the encapsulation of all of those elements of being, from the highest spiritual, subtle realm of the angels to the lowest realm of the minerals. So it's all encapsulated within the one human being. And the process of dying to each of these levels is what Ibn Arabi refers to in his Mi'raj, his spiritual ascension, when he said, I went from stage to stage in this ladder of being, which was all within his own heart. You ascend, in Dr. Ling's used to say, height equals depth, metaphysically speaking. So I went higher and higher, is the same thing as going, I went deeper and deeper. So he said, I went higher and higher in my personal Mi'raj, such that at each heaven within my own being, with each heaven, I relinquished that dimension of my being that was appropriate to that level of being, until I came to the point where all that was left of me was my contingency. And this is very much related to the idea of dying. My imkan, that which makes me what I am, my contingency, my possibility. He says, hasbi, hasbi, qad mala'at arkani. I've had enough, I've had enough. Hasbi, hasbi, this is it, I can't take any more. My elements, the elements of my being, have all been filled up. Mala'at arkani. Wala wasa'ani anni makani. My place cannot contain me anymore. Farrafa'a anni imkani. So he took from me, he lifted from me my very contingency, my possibility, my specificity, my individuality. That was the final act, if you like, of the slaying of the separate self, what Rabia al-Adawiya referred to so famously when she said to the man who came to her and said, I have not sinned for so many years. She said, your very existence is a sin to which no other can be compared. Which I think must have baffling. We wouldn't have got the metaphysics of that necessarily. So,
thank you anyway.
I mean, I want to just finish on that really by referring to, I think in the light of the discussion that you've just elicited, we can see more clearly what beauty is in that poem of Imam Ali that otherwise is quite baffling as well. That he says, he says, as if God is speaking now, as a kind of hadith Qudsi, he who seeks me finds me. He who finds me knows me. He who knows me loves me. He who loves me, I love him. And he whom I love, I slay, I kill. He whom I kill, I must requite. And he whom I must requite, I am the requital. I am the diya, the blood money. So God, in a certain sense, does kill. It's the final act of merciful grace to liberate ourselves from this ego. But what he kills, what he helps us to be liberated from, is that degree of existence which is the veil disguising or concealing God's own reality. So the slaying or the killing or the lifting of contingency, however one wants to symbolize it, is the final act of liberation. As I said at the beginning, these two liberations we should be concerned with. One, liberation from sin, which is a liberation from egotism. The second is the liberation from the ego, and that means liberation from a degree of wujud, a degree of existence, which is the greatest of all sins, as Rabia said. It's the sin because it covers over the universal reality. Universal being, our particular being becomes a veil over the universal one. So finally getting rid of this is liberation in the ultimate sense of the Hindu term moksha. We're delivered from the Atman, and instead the Paramatman is realized through us. Exactly what Imam Ali's poem says. When God slays you because he loves you, he becomes the replacement for you. He's the blood money. I am myself, I give myself to you once I've killed you. I now come alive within you more completely, now that you have become dead to your own limitative, separative existence. So there was one more question.
You were talking about different stages of nafs, and as far as I understood, the last is self-accusing nafs.
No, the last is the nafs of what's not in
there. I didn't
understand. Content, soul. I don't know if you got the question there. It's just a clarification on the relationship between the nafs of lawama and the nafs of mutma'inna, and the reality of what is meant by spiritual death prior to death. The simplest way, I think, to answer this question is to refer to a hadith of the Blessed Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam: "Mutu qabla an tamutu." Die, he said, before you die. Undergo a death in this outward life, which is this death I'm speaking about, the death first of egotism, which will give you virtue. By the grace of God, there may be a second liberation from the ego, and that is the grace of sanctification. So the first liberation is from egotism, which will give you virtue. The second liberation, by God's grace, the sincerity of our effort, and something unforeseeable, is the grace where he makes you aware that you are nothing. As Meister Eckhart says, the creature is not a something, not even a tiny something. The creature is a pure nothing. And every thought that you have is a creature that is as big as God. Because the thought that you have of a creature eliminates from your mind the totality of God's being in illusory form. So that's why Eckhart said, hate your own soul. Realize that your soul is your greatest enemy. And the meditation that he recommended is exactly the same as the essence of the invocatory life that the Sufis insist upon. Because when you invoke the divine name, or when you concentrate on your own nothingness, and you concentrate exclusively on the somethingness of God, there is something there, an ultimate reality, that alone is real, you are unreal. You're already beginning to die to a false conception of your own existence as being something autonomous and separate. It's not. Your being is derivative and secondary, a reflection of something that is more real. So when you do the invocation of the divine name, again I refer to Imam Ali's wonderful illumination of what happens in the invocation. He said, the perfection of dhikr, the dhikr kamil, is when your tongue saying Allah, 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 is in perfect conformity with your heart. So your heart intends God and is purifying itself for God, just as your tongue is trying to purify itself for God and saying it. So that's what he calls dhikr kamil, a perfect conformity, sincerity of what you're saying and what you're doing and intending. Heartfelt invocation. But, he says, you will not attain the haqiqa of the dhikr, the spiritual reality of dhikr, hatta tansa nafsaka fi dhikrika, until you forget yourself in your remembrance. So he deliberately has this paradox. The spiritual reality of remembrance is predicated on the deepest act of forgetfulness. The more fully and deeply and effectively you can truly forget yourself, the more likely it is that your substance will be made receptive to the light of the one and only reality, in the face of which you are nothing. And this is why the Sufis talk about fana, as opposed to baqa. The fana of the nafs, the effacement, eclipse, extinction, you might even say extermination, something very apparently destructive, that this is the ultimate stage of realizing Tawheed. You read Al-Ghazali's work on the Mishkat al-Anwar. He says the highest saints are the ones who have realized their nothingness. The highest Tawheed is that they have realized their nothingness through their very unconsciousness of their unconsciousness. He says there are some people who are conscious of being unconscious, but that is still self-consciousness. But the highest muwahhidun, the highest tawheed, not ittihad, making one in a kind of willful sense, but tawheed, the realization of one, is when the saint, the Sufi, the muwahhid, is totally unconscious of his unconsciousness. That is the death. That means that you are the only consciousness that remains is that of God. So the consciousness of God realized through you is predicated on your total lack of self-consciousness. A state, it may be only a moment, it could be 3 days. In the Hindu tradition we have Shankara telling us that for the ripe souls, one hearing of tattvam asi is enough for total realization. That moment you suddenly become aware that what you took to be a snake in the dark was in fact a rope. That's the difference between thinking that I am something and realizing that God is the only reality. It can happen in a split second, a total realization, and thereafter, he says it like the ego has been cut off and thrown away, like an arm of your body. Someone cuts that off and throws it away, but you still remain. That's what happens when the ego self-consciousness has been eliminated, effaced. Something remains, and that's the real Atman, the Paramatman. No longer the jivatma, the specific atma. So, and that can take 3 days. Ramakrishna went into a samadhi for 3 days and nights and came out realizing God alone is real, the Brahma, nirguna, above and beyond all qualities. So the death that is in question here, and it sort of goes on in this question here, is a supreme entrance into life. The death of the ego is the death of the principle of separation. Therefore, it's the life of the reality of union. That's something along the lines of